You're listening to an archive edition of Think. I'm Chris Boyd. How would your life change if you went from being an exceptionally private person to a public figure against your will? And what would happen if that change also forced you to leave a job you had loved for two decades? Valerie Plame Wilson learned the hard way in the summer of 2003. Her husband, former Ambassador Joseph Wilson, had published an op-ed in the New York Times entitled "What I Didn't Find in Africa," referring to his diligent but unsuccessful effort to confirm that Iraq had bought yellowcake uranium from Niger in the lead-up to the U.S. invasion. 8 days later, a column written by Robert Novak revealed Plame's status as a CIA operative, effectively ending years of successful intelligence operations and endangering those she had worked with on covert missions. Today, Plame is out of the CIA, and she lives in New Mexico with her husband and 8-year-old twins. Last year, she published a memoir called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. She's in town to deliver the Louise B. Raggio Endowed Lecture in Women's Studies on the SMU campus tonight at 7:30, and we are delighted that she could make time to speak with us. Valerie, welcome to Think.
Thank you for having me here.
How political is the intelligence business?
Unfortunately, much more so, I would say, over the last 8 years. I think most Americans want to believe that whatever intelligence lands on the president's desk is devoid of ideological taint. There's not a political agenda because that's how it should be. It should be just the facts. In fact, what we have seen is an increasing amount of politics that have been allowed to intrude into what should be the highly professional and non-political world of intelligence collection and analysis.
So you were with the CIA long enough to have seen several presidential administrations change. Was it markedly different when the Bush administration came than it had been in the past?
I will need to let you know that the CIA has taken the position that I am not permitted to acknowledge my agency affiliation prior to January 2002. This despite all the information out there.
Let me say this. Public records say, the Congressional Quarterly and other things, and maybe I can say this for you that you're not allowed to say, say that you worked for the CIA between 1985 and 2006, which would make 20 years in a couple of weeks or something.
What I can say, and that we now know, in the run-up to the war with Iraq, Vice President Cheney and his then chief of staff, Scooter Libby, came out to CIA headquarters an unprecedented number of times to meet with analysts and talk to them about what they were finding. That's probably incorrect to say. What they were asking was the same question over and over again to try to fit the analysis into their already preconceived idea of reasons for going to war with Iraq. I find that absolutely appalling. I didn't know it at the time because I was on the operations side of the house. But generally speaking, someone of that stature, the senior U.S. policymaker, only comes out to CIA headquarters to cut ribbons or pin a medal on someone. They should not be over there talking to the analysts, getting down at that level. These analysts are very bright, professional people. And I think they get it when the same question keeps being asked over and over again. That's just one example. We now know that all those visits that preceded our invasion of Iraq.
How aware is the average CIA officer of the political or partisan views of her coworkers or his coworkers? Is it common for you to sort of know what other people in the office think?
I think that anyone serving in the CIA, as you would there in the intelligence community, throughout the diplomatic community, in the armed services, you serve as an American. When you're overseas, you're not a Democrat or a Republican. You are representing America, first and foremost. My recollection is that I rarely knew how people voted. Historically, the CIA has tended to be conservative because, of course, it draws into its ranks many former military officers and a strong believer in core Republican beliefs of, you know, strong national defense, strong fiscal policy, and so forth. But that they're professionals. They're intelligence professionals. You don't allow that to spill over into what sort of your analysis should look like or your collection. But I think it's fair to say, from the election of George Bush in 2000 and onward, just like the rest of the country, has become increasingly politicized, and it's no longer considered impolite to talk about politics at the dinner table or at the workplace. And I certainly heard people expressing their opinions more vividly in the latter part of my years at the CIA.
My guest is Valerie Plame Wilson, the former CIA covert operations officer. She's in town to deliver the Louise Raggio Lecture in Women's Studies tonight at SMU. What made you good at being a covert ops officer?
They do an intensive interview process, as you can imagine, to try to winnow out who they really need, what they need, the sort of profile. You may be familiar with the Myers-Briggs test. Apparently, I am an off-the-chart ENTJ, and for what that's worth, that was a profile of what they were looking for someone to go into operations. But I think what makes someone successful are a couple things. One, ability to think on your feet. That's true. I think in any, you know, you are successful if you can think quickly on your feet anywhere. However, the ramifications, if you don't make the right judgment call, are much higher when you are in operations, because you are responsible in many cases for someone else. And sometimes it's their life is on the line. So you need to make the right decision right away. Another quality I think they look for and is absolutely essential is your ability to adapt quickly to new situation. You can be dropped in to a country, into a room, and you get it. You get it right away. You understand what's going on. And then you're comfortable with that, and you can pick up clues. Finally, I would say there's a it's difficult to describe, but most ops officers, I would say, want to have the security of knowing that their family is safe. They have health insurance and so forth. They're government workers at the end of the day, of course. However, within that parameter, they are willing to break the rules. And that's a strange combination.
Just to go back for a minute, for people who don't know the Myers-Briggs, ENTJ means you're an extrovert, you're intuitive, you are a thinker rather than a feeler, mm-hmm. and you are one who makes judgments instead of sort of perceiving the mm-hmm. situation. Mm-hmm. So it makes sense with everything that you've just described. when you were first dating your husband, he did not know what you really did for a living. He thought you were in the energy trade, is that right?
Again, this goes back to my caveat
It has been reported elsewhere. I'm not sure how much you can say. I'm curious as to if you can talk about the point at which you first talked to him about what you did.
I can say it was love at first sight. And when it became clear that the relationship was serious, I needed, of course, to explain to him that the situation was a little different than what he might have thought it was.
That has to be sort of and I'm not talking here about a professional risk, but it has to be almost a romantic risk to let someone in on something that is could be perceived as a huge secret and something that feels like a deception.
I can say that at the time that my covert CIA identity was betrayed in July 2003, only a handful of people outside of the CIA knew where I worked. The ramifications of that are quite serious. It's not just me and my network, but the ripple effect of that. There might be people out there in foreign countries that have intelligence of critical importance to our national security, and they would like to share that for whatever their motivation might be with U.S. intelligence, and they hear about my story, and they think, well, you know, why would I jeopardize myself if they can't keep one of their own safe? I will just go take my information down the street and sell it to the Russians or whatever.
And I guess as well, your face, your name, your profile is run through databases in every country that you may have had occasion to even visit. And then people are cross-checking this to see, well, has she been here? Has she stayed in this hotel? Has she talked to this person?
Exactly. I mean, even people with whom I had a completely innocuous relationship, there's a shadow of doubt cast over them because of our connection. And for that, I'm terribly sorry, because there were a lot of innocent relationships. But that is why what happened is so insidious. It was much more than just political payback. The consequences were quite serious for our national security.
So let's talk about why good Americans who care about national security would decide that it was in their interest and in the interest of the United States to reveal your identity, to sort of get back at your husband. First of all, let's talk about the circumstances in which he went to Niger, because there's been some confusion about that. It has been asserted by some people that you assigned him on this mission, that you said, let's send my husband. He's perfect for this work.
Exactly. That is one of the Republican talking points, that it was nepotism, that Niger was a boondoggle. First of all, anyone who knows anything about Africa would never call a trip to Niger a boondoggle. But let me explain how it came about. In February 2002, there had been several reports circulating at some weeks within the intelligence community about this alleged sale of yellowcake uranium from Niger to Iraq. And if proven true, that would be quite significant. It would demonstrate that, in fact, Saddam Hussein was seeking to reconstitute his nuclear program. I was at CIA headquarters. A young woman who was working for me came up to me quite agitated because she had just received a phone call at her desk from the office of the vice president asking about this report. First of all, I have to say I was quite nonplussed because that was absolutely unheard of. We have entire channels and protocols for a senior U.S. policymaker. If they have a question on a briefing or report, it goes down the chain of command, find the answer, and goes back up. You don't just ring up a junior officer at headquarters and say, so what do you know about this? So that was very strange. But as we were discussing this, a reports officer was passing by and he heard what was going on. He said, well, what about Joe, meaning Joe Wilson, my husband? And he suggested Joe for several reasons. One, he knew that Joe had served for over 20 years as a U.S. diplomat on the continent of Africa. He knew sort of everyone there was to know. Secondly, he knew that Joe had served as a charge d'affaires at our embassy in Baghdad during the first Gulf War. He had met with Saddam Hussein. He helped arrange the safe release of hundreds of American hostages, for which the first President Bush called him a true American hero. And he knew also that Joe had done a previous mission similar for the CIA. So he said, well, what about Joe? And I said, well, let's go talk to our boss. And we did. We told him what was going on. And my boss said, well, Valerie, when you go home tonight, could you please ask Joe to come into CIA headquarters next week? We'll get the right people around the table, figure out what makes sense. And that he did that. I was not at that meeting.
And let me stop you for a second. He was mostly doing consulting work and different
kinds of
things.
That's correct. He had at that point been retired from the U.S. government, a 24-year career in foreign service for several years. And he had his own consulting business. So he came in at that meeting. As subsequent documentary and witness evidence came out in Mr. Libby's trial, it turned out that everyone wanted him to go except Joe Wilson and the Department of State, the representatives there. The reason being, there were already two reports in government files saying that this transfer, these reports, were most likely bogus. One from a 4-star Army general, one from our ambassador there on the ground. But Joe's a good citizen. It's a serious question. It deserved a serious answer. He went pro bono. And that is how the trip came about. I had nothing to do with it whatsoever, other than conveying the wish of my supervisor to go home that evening and ask Joe, are you free next Tuesday? Can you come into headquarters?
Did he go thinking that he might, in fact, find that there had been a weapons sale from Niger to Iraq?
I don't know what I know. He tried to go with an open mind and get to the bottom of what happened. He certainly was well known in Nigerian government circles because he had been sent out there a few years previously to try to talk the military out of power and go back into the military barracks. So he was highly regarded.
Valerie Plame Wilson is my guest. She's in town to deliver the Louise B. Raggio Endowed Lecture in Women's Studies tonight on the SMU campus at 7:30. You can find information about the appearance on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join the conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Or send email to think@KERA.org. Chris Boyd, you're listening to an archive edition of Think. My guest this hour is former CIA Covert Operations Officer Valerie Plame Wilson. She's in town to deliver the endowed lecture in women's studies at SMU tonight. That'll happen at 7:30. You can find information on the Think page of KERA.org. If you want to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-9-
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
So let's go back to 2003. The U.S. has already invaded Iraq. Your husband, having returned from his mission to Niger without much evidence at all that it was likely that Niger had sold yellowcake uranium, decided he had to speak out publicly. First of all, have you talked about why he waited until after the invasion to come forward with that information?
Just so your listeners have an idea of the chronology, his trip occurred in February 2002. President Bush gave his State of the Union address, in which he said the now infamous 16 words, the British government has learned that Saddam Hussein has recently sought significant quantities of uranium from Africa. That was in January 2003. So through the invasion and the aftermath, this story that there was this transfer of yellowcake uranium was sort of bubbling on the back burner all the time. And it started to get louder and louder as spring went into summer. In June, then National Security Advisor Condoleezza Rice went on Meet the Press, I believe, and said rather dismissively, oh, well, maybe someone knew about that down in the bowels of the agency, but certainly no one in my circles. And Joe knew that not to be true. And as he also in those intervening months tried very hard to get to the heart of those 16 words, discreetly, using his former colleagues at State Department, talking to staffers on the Hill. And everyone said essentially, well, if you want to do anything about it, you have to do it yourself. So ultimately, he decided to sit down in July 2003 and write this op-ed piece. It was very straightforward. It was 1,500 words. It was not a screed for impeachment. It just said, this is what I know. And it certainly doesn't match with what the American people have been told. That I think Joe used the phrase that intelligence had been manipulated. And that infuriated the administration, which at that particular point was fighting very hard against the obvious the obvious revelation that there was no WMD in Iraq. And I think they reacted so severely because, in fact, Joe did have credibility given his background and what he had done to that point. And they felt it deeply. And they reacted a week later by leaking my name and then its subsequent appearance in a column.
And Robert Novak had called your husband for a comment and spoken with him, I guess at some length, but he didn't want to discuss you, your husband, that is. But you were sort of prepared for what might be coming. Was there part of you still that thought, oh, he won't do anything with this because there's nothing to it?
Absolutely. Of course, I informed my superiors at CIA that a journalist, Robert Novak, had this information. Which we knew from the time, days following Joe's op-ed piece. And that is not it's not totally unusual, but in Washington there are certain rules. Apparently Novak called CIA public relations and said, you know, what's to this? And they said, you know, no, don't go with this. Novak said later it was a soft no, to which the only reply should be, what part of no did you not understand? You know, Novak is hardly a Washington novice. He's been around the block decades. And he would understand if there's a name in CIA that they shouldn't go there. But they decided to pursue it anyway.
And there's not, it's not even a misdemeanor, though, to reveal your identity?
There's something called the Intelligence Identities Protection Act, IIPA. Under those rules, it's those that have the security clearance, such as Mr. Libby, for instance, and then breach that are in violation. The journalists themselves are not. I mean, there's a cutout for them because they don't have the security clearance. It's not against the law for them to print a name. It is against the law for someone with a security clearance to relay that information. And it's pretty clear now as we look back on the aftermath and what we know from the evidence presented at Mr. Libby's trial that there were several within the White House, within the administration, over at State Department that were talking to reporters about me and my name and my alleged role in Joe's trip
So this column came out on a Monday morning. What was it like to walk into work? When was the next day that you had to sort of walk into the office, briefcase in hand?
It was a horror. Because I knew my career was over, doing what I loved. I was very proud to serve my country. I loved my career. I was working primarily on counterproliferation issues, I should say, exclusively. I knew that the network of assets with whom I had worked were in jeopardy. As it so happened, that week that it came out, I was not at headquarters. I was at another building taking some management trainee course, which, you know, you're supposed to do every so often. However, I was in close contact with my supervisors and trying, you know, what next? And in fact, there was a period of relative quiet from when it appeared in July until the end of September, when the CIA referred the leak to the Justice Department for further investigation. And that's when it all sort of blew up.
Yeah. Was there a lot of empathy on the part of your supervisors and your coworkers, or were you sort of that poison person that nobody wanted to get too close to all of a sudden?
I think certainly my coworkers understood the implications. They better than anyone. You know, it was me, but it could have easily been them. But if this quickly became such a political hot potato that I was a little bit, you know, like nuclear waste, you know. And I didn't expect a lot of hand-holding, but there was almost non-existent contact between myself and any senior CIA directors as this unfolded.
1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
My guest is Mallory Plame Wilson. Let's speak to Pete in Arlington. Hello, Pete.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking the call. Great program today. Ms. Plame, you mentioned that the frequency of calls by high-level policymakers directly to the analysts was unprecedented. My question is, what processes are now in place that would flag that immediately and make sure the DCI knows about it? Or did the DCI know about it then and passively turn a blind eye and allow it to happen? And would the flags then immediately notify the chairman of the Intelligence Oversight Committees? I'll take your answer off the air. Thank you very much.
Thanks for your call.
Thank you. That's an excellent question. I resigned from the CIA in January 2006, so I'm out of the business as of that. So my observations might be a bit outdated. We had in place what I thought were sufficient safeguards for information to travel to senior policymakers and back down to get answers and back. This really was an anomaly. I recall being told on numerous occasions that should anyone receive a call from an office outside of the CIA, you know, much less the media, report it immediately and we'll take care of it. I mean, that was just sort of a given. I don't know what they have done in the intervening time to perhaps change those or provide more safeguards. I think it is fair to say that the Congressional Oversight Committee on the Senate side, it's the Senate Select Committee on Intelligence. On the House side, it's the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. They have abrogated their oversight responsibilities. They have been completely compromised, I believe, in how they have proceeded to understand what is the relationship between the executive branch and the legislative branch and their oversight responsibilities. I do hope that with a new administration in place that that the new committees take their responsibilities more seriously and more actively.
We have an email from Dan in Tulsa who says, as an 11-year military veteran, I was outraged to find out what the Bush administration did to Ms. Plame. Is there any possibility that once they leave office, you can pursue legal action against them?
We haven't waited till they left office. My husband and I filed a civil suit against Vice President Cheney, Scooter Libby, Dick Armitage, Karl Rove, and others. The point of that civil suit was to get at the truth of what happened, because as you may recall, Mr. Libby was convicted on obstruction of justice, which meant we didn't finally get to the bottom of what happened. The special prosecutor in the case, Patrick Fitzgerald, noted that there was a cloud over the office of the vice president, but because of the obstruction of justice, couldn't finally get at that. We did it for accountability. Joe and I believe that public servants should not use their power and their office to pursue partisan agendas. And finally, for the future, we hope that that my case is an anomaly, that it doesn't happen again. The case we will be applying to the Supreme Court. We've gone through the appeals process. We will be applying to the Supreme Court to hear the case so that these government officials are held to account.
You write candidly about the fact that this had no small impact on your relationship with your husband, on your marriage. Can you talk a little bit about the sort of cycle of guilt and blame and empathy and outrage that you both dealt with?
There were some very dark days. So everything was out of our control. These pressures were external pressures. I mean, they weren't created by, you know, a spouse drinking or wandering off. I mean, these were crazy things that we never could have anticipated. And because until January 2006, I was a CIA employee, I could not speak publicly. And my husband, even though he understood that, it was still painful for him to be attacked as he was. And it was a years-long character assassination campaign. He was called a liar, a traitor. I was accused of nepotism. So he was on his own for much of that time trying to fight back. And every time he would actually answer one of the charges, he was accused of, you know, grandstanding rather than protecting his character and integrity.
And then he's not getting any work.
No, of course. Yeah, his consulting business completely dried up. And our life had become a media circus. As you pointed out, the change from going from being a very private person to a public persona is terrible. I had never dreamed that this was something I had aspired to, any sort of public recognition. I drew my satisfaction from my job. So all these things combined made some really very difficult times in our marriage, but we have survived. We are stronger and more in love. And we joke that, we've actually been married 25 years, because it's been distilled down, even though we were married in 98. We've packed a lot of living into those 10 years.
I have to imagine the CIA would approve of you saying 25, even though it's been 10. Because who wants to tell the exact amount of time? We have an email from Rollins who asks, was there ever a time when you became genuinely frightened as you appraised the compounding personal and professional betrayals?
We were certainly very cognizant of our security situation. As I write in my book, in the spring of 2004, I received a very credible threat that was not only directed at me, but ironically at George Tenet, CIA Director Karl Rove, and John Ashcroft. And at that point, I went to the head of CIA security and I asked for a review and security on my residence because that's where I felt the most vulnerable. And Joe and I had always said, you know, whatever happens to us, but we had small children. Their safety, of course, was paramount. And the CIA did the review and they came back to me and they declined to provide any sort of security on our residence. And it was such a blow. It felt like another betrayal all over again. I wasn't asking for lifetime Secret Service. It was what I had asked for was through the election of the presidential election of November 2004, because I thought that was the most volatile time. And it just was so painful. That's one episode I write about, but we continue to be vigilant.
And you effectively had to you have preschool kids at this time. You had to give your nanny tips on sort of avoiding threats.
How bizarre is that? Yeah, well, I'm
only
sharing
one apple juice. And, yeah, never take the same route home.
Exactly, and it was horrifying when you think of what could happen to your children, as any parent would feel. But yes, there I am giving my nanny, whose English was not her strong suit, tips on how to, on surveillance detection and so forth. And to her credit, bless her heart, she tried to, she would protect those babies with her life. I know she would. It just turned our lives into a circus. There's nothing like it when you open your front door and there's a photographer there. It's hard to describe.
1-800-933-5555.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's speak next to Natalie in Wichita Falls. Hi, Natalie.
Hello, yes. Another wonderful show, Chris.
Thank you.
Hello to your guest there, Miss Flame. I'm sorry you're so vilified by the nation here through the run-up to our war here. I wondered if you knew much about or could even comment about a similar situation to yours that was transpiring to the run-up to the war in Iraq in England. This involved a Mandarin Chinese translator working at GCHQ, an intelligence group in Cheltenham, England, and her name is Catherine Gunn. And she was pretty much raked over the coals regarding a memo that was sent to her and perhaps others in that intelligence outfit regarding surveillance and wiretapping of certain members of the UN, and to probably to strongly encourage others to sign on to a war that has always been questioned in its legality. So I wondered if you could at all comment about that case.
Thanks for your call, Natalie.
Thanks. No, I know very few facts about that case. I'm aware of it only in tangentially, so it wouldn't do any good for me to make any comment at all.
I wonder if you often hear from people who, for whatever reason, whether justified or not, sort of feel that they've experienced something like you, and then you have to
think.
Oh,
of course. I'm like a magnet for conspiracy theorists. You know, everyone, it seems, every public outing I have, there's someone who comes up to me about the 9/11 and what really happened, you know.
Valerie Plame Wilson is my guest. She will be delivering the Louise B. Raggio Endowed Lecture in Women's Studies tonight at SMU. That's at the Hughes Trigg Student Center at 7:30. You can find more information on the Think page of KERA.org. We'll be back to our conversation in a moment. You can join us by sending email to think@KERA.org. Listening to an archive edition of Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is former CIA covert operations officer Valerie Plame Wilson. She wrote a book last year, which is still in publication, called Fair Game: My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. If you want to join us, the number is 1-800-9.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Think@KERA.org. What do you think, Valerie, that you symbolize today for the people who have followed your story?
I think our story illuminates a broader pattern of behavior by this current administration of disregard for the rule of law, and certainly no tolerance whatsoever for any sort of dissent, civil or otherwise. When this happened in July 2003, it really was the first pushback. That is, you know, Joe's op-ed piece was the first significant pushback to this administration pertaining to the war in Iraq, because they were on a juggernaut until then. And it was considered truly, you know, unpatriotic to even question. Well, of course, you know, of course we should do this. And if, as we heard more than once, if you're not with us, you're against us. You know, you're part of the whole terrorist cabal. And in fact, Joe and I both deeply believe that it is a citizen's responsibility to hold your government to account for their words and deeds, and that dissent, if done in a civil manner, should be part of the dialogue. What is the most important thing that a country does but send its young men and women into battle? And you better have a really good reason to do so and have a national dialogue, particularly in this war, which I think could be accurately termed a war of choice. It was a preemptive war. And the period of national dialogue was cut short.
I think no one would say it was strictly a matter of intelligence or the way that intelligence was presented that, that caused this war to happen. But I'm wondering what you think about how we can allow the CIA and the NSA and the Pentagon to be fully accountable to the American people when so much of what takes place is really not available for us to review.
Certainly under this administration, they have used the national security rubric as a bludgeon. You know, it's for everything. And they basically told the American people, trust us, we know what we're doing, and proceeded that way. I am a firm believer in a strong intelligence service. Unfortunately, that's the reality of the world. We live in a world where our leaders still need to understand sometimes classified information to make the right choices. However, it should not be politicized, as we spoke about earlier. There's a lot of work, I would say, for the incoming president to take care of.
1-800.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's speak to Todd in Fort Worth. Hi, Todd.
Yeah, thanks, Chris, for taking my call. I love your show.
Thank you.
Yeah, I have a question for Ms. Blaine. You know, I sympathize with your situation, and I think I we do not wish it to anybody for the kind of good work you do. I'm just concerned, Ms. Blaine, did you really honestly believe within yourself that sending your husband or even introducing him to such charged atmosphere, knowing that you are undercover, do you think that was the best decision and right way to go?
Thanks for the question, because what I think most Americans do not understand is the nature of cover. And certainly mine was completely intact at the time that it was betrayed. It becomes a way of life. And I never had anyone question what I was doing. As I noted earlier, Joe wrote his op-ed piece based on his existing credentials. It had nothing to do with me, his wife. It was what he had done in his career and his capacity to speak cogently on what was happening. When he went, he was, as I say, he was asked to do so. He thought it was an important enough question. He wanted to help his government if he could. He went. He reported back that there was nothing to this. And it wasn't until over a year later when it was very clear, even more so, that the government had cherry-picked the intelligence. Some have questioned, why did they send, Joe Wilson? He was well-known, partisan player. That is not true. At the time he went in February 2002, he had not spoken publicly or written anything at all about a possible war with Iraq. And he has served, of course, under Republican and Democratic presidents with equal zeal and patriotism.
1-800-933.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's go next to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hello. And hello, Ms. Wilson. First of all, I'd like to thank you for your long years of service to the United States. We appreciate it. And congratulations on having a stronger family now than you did. I know it was tough. And my question concerns American intelligence in general. I know throughout history, we've been surprised by a few things. Pearl Harbor, the Chinese invading North Korea, and, of course, 9/11. It seems in each of those instances, the clues were there. The pieces of the puzzle were on the table. However, different pieces were on different tables within the intelligence community, and no one was making a real intelligent effort to coordinate them. Now, I understand Homeland Security that's one of the duties of Homeland Security now. Do you feel that that's happening now and that going forward we'll have more coordination of these little tidbits of intelligence that often add up to very good information on things that perhaps we might not be so surprised by things? Thank you.
Thanks for your call.
Thanks for the question. It's very clear now, one of the factors that led to 9/11 was the lack of information sharing between the FBI and the CIA. It was abysmal. That has improved slightly, but I'm afraid that we're really no safer off today than we were 7 years ago. And that is in part because there was a 9/11 commission, and they hastily put out some recommendations on how to, quote, reform the intelligence community. In part, that resulted in the creation of something called the DNI, Director of National Intelligence, that is now run Admiral McConnell, which is sort of a superstructure over the whole intelligence community. Most people that you ask will tell you they have no idea what it actually does. Does it actually improve coordination? I personally believe that the intelligence community right now is so bloated and so unfortunately so riddled with outsourcing to the private sector and so forth, and of course the politicization that we have spoken about, Americans are simply not getting the bang for their buck, if you will, on intelligence. You have really good professional people who have dedicated their lives to keeping America safe. But the yoke that they're working under right now is quite heavy.
1-800-933-5.
Please don't call now. The show has been pre-recorded.
Let's speak next to, we will go next to Bert in Dallas. Hi, Bert.
Hi. There's two forgeries, Ms. Plame, I'd like you to illuminate on. I think the press has been really remiss in getting the story out, first on the Yellow Cake forgery of dubious origins that involved your husband, and the one that Ron Suskin broke, which is really damning, the forgery that came from, you know, they paid Iraqi intelligence, head of Iraqi intelligence, Habush, they escorted him out of the country long after the war was started, gave him $5 million in hush money, and then his name linking his name to a memo to Saddam linking Al-Qaeda and uranium. Mm-hmm. And it's just outrageous that story is not all over the place without a congressional investigation. Could you comment on those?
Absolutely. There's a good book out there written a couple years ago now, The Italian Letter, which talks about all the different, it tries to pull together all the different threads on how that initial forgery came to be. And it goes from the Italian news magazine Panorama, I think, and the journalist and the shady Italian Karen Rocco, someone or other. It's all over the place. It's very well done and well researched. The bottom line is they were not able to ultimately decide where that forgery originated from. As an intelligence officer, I always start with the question of who benefits, who would have benefited from this sort of shocking letter. If, you know, proven true, well, you know, there's a couple possibilities. There's Mossad for obvious reasons. There's former intelligence officers that might have thought it was a twisted joke and took it too far. They're very interesting, but I don't have any more insight ultimately on where that came from. Your second point is from Ron Suskind's very good book, The Way of the World. And that did make a little bit of a splash when it came out. But like so many things that I find so shocking, it just sort of disappears in the next news cycle. What you're describing essentially was was domestic propaganda, which is expressly forbidden by our laws and regulations in the Constitution. That's exactly what happened, that this letter purportedly signed by a senior Iraqi official that talked about links between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein, which, if true, would be, support many of the administration's officials' claims that these links to al-Qaeda existed. Outrageous. Of course, when that came out publicly, it was pretty clear that the White House joined ranks with the senior CIA official who Suskind was, Rob Reicher, who Suskind was quoting and said that, you know, this is false. There's nothing to this. I don't know if there will be or is a congressional probe into what happened here. Perhaps in the new administration, it'll be very interesting to see how much the new administration cares to uncover some of the excesses of the old.
It has been 5 years since your husband published this op-ed, and you were outed, a little more than 5 years. We are still at war. Do you think that his going public with the information that he had made a difference in the course of how things went for anyone other than your family?
I think it did provide the first shot, if you will, of saying there were a couple others, but none that got the media attention because of the consequence of my betrayal and so forth. Bart Gellman's book, Angler, which is about Vice President Cheney, he makes it very clear that the vice president and his staff, including David Addington and others, who's now his chief of staff, said, we're going to push as hard as we can until we meet resistance. And I like to think that Joe's op-ed piece was a first piece of resistance that they came up against. And it began to unravel. It would have, I think, unraveled anyway under its own weight. I do ultimately believe in our system of justice and that good people do try to do the right thing. Frankly, this administration has been absolutely radical in its approach to the Constitution and the need for how we use national security. And it has cost us dearly in our moral and political standing in the world. It's changed, of course, our personal life dramatically, but that really at the end of the day has no bearing on anything. I think of the thousands of American families that have lost their loved ones in Iraq or Afghanistan or have someone who's served and severely wounded come back. Those are the lives that are terribly altered forever. Joe and I are, we have our family, we have our children, we will go on. But there's others, not to mention the tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Iraqi civilians that have been displaced and terribly hurt by this war.
So is it a sacrifice that you would willingly make again if you had known what was coming?
Oh, we'd do it all over again. Knowing what we know now. Yes, because we felt we had no choice. Of course we didn't know any of this would happen, but we felt we had no choice.
You can see Valerie Plame Wilson tonight at 7:30 on the SMU campus, where she is delivering the Louise B. Raggio Endowed Lecture in Women's Studies. Her book is called Fair Game, My Life as a Spy, My Betrayal by the White House. Valerie, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you for having me.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thank you for listening and have a great day.
Think is produced by Jeff Whittington and engineered by Jeannie Mascoro. Learn about upcoming programs, subscribe to our free daily podcast, and order CD copies of your favorite Think shows on the radio page of KERA.org. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@KERA.org.